Germany, the United States and Soviet armies met at the River Elbe. Americans and Russians joined hands in celebration of victory. Successful partners in war, the hope flamed among all men that the United States and the Soviet Union, with their allies, would form a successful partnership against any future threat of aggression. The news of final surrender, the news that peace had at last been won, penetrated to every corner of the globe. Peace, the hope of mankind, had arrived. Men rejoiced, cheered the end of World War II.
There was a brief moment in time when the United States, alone among the victors, was on top of the world. Its death toll was 405,000 compared to the Soviet Union's 27 million. The economy was booming, exports more than doubled pre-war levels. Industrial production had grown 15% annually. The U.S. held two-thirds of the world's gold reserves and three-fourths of its invested capital. It was producing an incredible 50% of the world's goods and services. In 1945, at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, the U.S. established the two new major economic institutions of capitalism, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, each budgeted at approximately $7 to $8 billion. President Harry Truman, who had made his name investigating excess spending in the Senate, was overseeing a gigantic demobilization. And yet, there was a lingering unease in a new society where the home front had prospered while the servicemen were away.
I can see that you had a splendid war record, Derry.
Just average, Mr. Thor.
But you'll understand that since this business changed hands, we're under no legal obligation to give you your old job back.
No, I wasn't thinking of getting my old job back, Mr. Thorpe. I'm looking for better ones.
What are your qualifications? Your experience?
2 years behind a soda fountain and 3 years behind a Norden bomb sight.
Yeah. Well, while in the Army, did you have any experience in procurement?
No.
Purchasing of supplies, materials?
No, I didn't do any of that. I just dropped bombs.
Did you do any personnel work?
No.
But as an officer, you surely had to act in an executive capacity. You had to command men. You were responsible for the morale.
No, I was only responsible for getting the bombs on the target. I didn't command anybody.
I see. I'm sure that work required great skill. But unfortunately, we've no opportunities for that with Midway drugs.
Yeah.
World War II left as many as 70 million people dead in Europe and Asia, two-thirds of them civilians. Hiroshima was an ominous forewarning. The Depression was perhaps over, but America's business and social planners feared a relapse and fretted over the consequences of worldwide poverty with populations uprooted, homeless, and unemployed. Would revolution sweep the globe? What would happen to American trade and investment? In France, the Communist Party, which had 500,000 members and fought bravely in the resistance to the Nazis, won 26% of the vote in 1945. In Italy, 1.7 million people joined the party. Even in Britain, the people, exhausted and broke from two world wars, were uncharacteristically turning to the state to make their lives tolerable. And fortune, which had made Winston Churchill one of the most respected statesmen of his era, now cast him aside with a reversal befitting Greek tragedy.
Winston Churchill touring the ruins of Berlin as the curtain rings down on his career as Prime Minister of Great Britain. Beneath flags of the big three, the 70-year-old leader stands at last in the heart of Berlin as he vowed he would 5 years ago. Admiral King and General Marshall come up to greet the old warrior. Next to General Marshall can be seen balding, mustached Clement Attlee, new Labour Prime Minister.
Attlee embodied the new socialist European, promising to build a free healthcare system for all and advocating the complete nationalization of many of Britain's oldest industries. A man preoccupied not with empire, but with a massive social welfare state. By contrast, Churchill was offering empire. He had said in late 1942, at a time when England's very existence was threatened,
I have not become the King's first minister to preside over the liquidation of the British Empire.
But dismemberment is exactly what he would live to see. Attlee would administer the independence of India, Pakistan, Burma, Sri Lanka, Jordan, and Palestine. Attlee understood that there was a new American world order. The U.S. extended almost a $4 billion loan to Britain, not to be repaid for 50 years, and was now leasing military bases on English soil. Britain, in essence, was to become a new client state of the U.S. Franklin Roosevelt, who had always disliked the concept of king and empire and reflected much of the American disapproval of its repressive policies in India, Greece, and throughout the world, had successfully steered a middle course between Great Britain and the Soviet Union. The prospect of a large American credit to help the Soviets rebuild had been encouraged and discussed openly during the war. But Harry Truman showed none of Roosevelt's dexterity as he tacked at a time of maximum U.S. strength, increasingly towards the British camp. When the Soviet Union did not receive anything close to the aid package given the British, they were greatly disappointed. They already sensed the wartime alliance would be the first casualty of the post-war era. In mid-September 1945, at a foreign ministers' meeting in London, Secretary of State Jimmy Burns berated Soviet policies in Eastern Europe. Foreign Minister Molotov pointed to exclusionary U.S. policies in Italy, Greece, and Japan, and tired of Burns's belligerence, asked if he was hiding an atomic bomb in his pocket. Burns actually replied,
"You don't know Southerners. We carry our artillery in our pocket. If you don't cut out all this stalling, I'm going to pull an atomic bomb out of my pocket and let you have it."
In December, Secretary of Commerce Henry Wallace pressed Truman to take control of America's atomic weapons away from Soviet hater Leslie Groves, who still had unilateral control over them. Groves had advocated a preemptive attack against any potential rival trying to make or possess atomic weapons. The Soviet Union, with the largest army in the world and having played the leading role in the anti-fascist movement, was now a frightening prospect for some U.S. officials. In early 1946, a Gallup poll found that 26% of Americans thought the Soviets sought world domination. 13% thought the British did. The Soviets, though aware of the rightward shift in the Truman administration, were hoping still to maintain the wartime alliance and actually went out of their way to restrain their frustrated communist allies in China, Italy, France, and Greece. Stalin, whose major foreign policy goal was to make certain Germany or Japan never again posed a threat to his country, had enormous problems at home. His nation was in the grip of a crushing poverty, engaged still in extensive ongoing partisan warfare in its western sectors, particularly Ukraine, which was soon to be racked with famine. The Soviets were isolated at the UN, and the U.S. had a monopoly on the bomb. Yet, the U.S. was building an image of the Soviet Union as being out to conquer the world. In Germany, the two systems were already at odds. Roosevelt's policy of pastoralizing Germany was reversed to one revitalizing the German economy as a key to an overall European recovery. This was not in itself a bad decision given what happened to West Germany in later years, but at the time, it was highly insensitive to the concerns of a country that had been twice cornered in ruthless wars with Germany. There was, in fact, a profound conflict of interest, and the stark images of the Soviets stripping the Eastern Zone of everything to ship back to its own impoverished land was, to most Americans, perceived, not incorrectly, as looting. As far back as the 19th century, the pre-communist Russian Empire had been in conflict with the British Empire, both seeking influence in Turkey and Iran. Russia had repeatedly sought access to the warm water ports of the Mediterranean. In the 1917 Russian Revolution, Churchill, as Lord of the Admiralty, had been a fierce foe of communism, which he proclaimed ought to be strangled in its cradle. He'd wanted to draw the United States into a military engagement with the new communist regime. And in the fierce counter-revolution against it, 40,000 British and 15,000 American troops actually participated, poisoning relations from the start. It had been Roosevelt who finally recognized the Soviet Union in 1933. Churchill, out of office and favor, was now itching for a confrontation. It would happen, not unsurprisingly, in the Middle East. Great Britain controlled 72% of Middle Eastern oil. The U.S. had 10% and wanted a bigger share. The Soviet Union wanted a piece too. Having stationed troops during the war across its border in northern Iran to keep oil supplies out of Nazi hands, the Soviets now came into conflict with Britain in the south. Churchill additionally felt threatened by Soviet probes in Turkey, threatening Britain's sphere of interest in the Middle East. The exposure of a Soviet espionage ring in Canada in early February added credibility to his warnings. And a speech by Stalin, in which he proclaimed a new post-war five-year plan to rebuild the Soviet Union, was misunderstood as incendiary in predicting the inevitability of a war between the two systems, which it had not. It was in this context, in early March 1946, that Winston Churchill would remind the world that he was still a power to be reckoned with. He traveled to Truman's home state, Fulton, Missouri, to make one of the most devastating speeches of the Cold War, words that would condemn forever in the minds of many the Soviet Union.
Mr. Churchill, he's one of the great men of the age. He's a great Englishman, but he's half American.
From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. In a great number of countries, the Communist parties or fifth columns constitute a growing challenge and peril to Christian civilization.
I do not believe that Soviet Russia desires war. What they desire is the fruits of war and the indefinite expansion of their power and doctrines.
This was a quantum leap in belligerence towards the Soviet Union. The New York Times applauded the speech, saying it was spoken with the force of a prophet proved right before. Visibly upset, Stalin accused Churchill of being in bed with the warmongers who followed the racial theory that only English speakers could decide the fate of the whole world. The Chicago Tribune, although agreeing with his assessment of Eastern Europe, sharply questioned Churchill's begging assistance for that old and evil empire to maintain British tyranny throughout the world. We cannot become partners in slaveholding. Florida's Senator Claude Pepper observed that Churchill was as much opposed to Russia as to a labor government in his own country. It is shocking to see Mr. Churchill align himself with the old Chamberlain Tories who strengthened the Nazis as part of their anti-Soviet crusade. The following month, on the first anniversary of Roosevelt's death, Wallace offered a different vision.
The only way to defeat communism in the world is to do a better and smoother job of production and distribution. Let's make it a clean race, a determined race, but above all, a peaceful race in the service of humanity. The source of all our mistakes is fear. Russia fears Anglo-Saxon encirclement. We fear communist penetration. Out of fear, great nations have been acting like cornered beasts, thinking only of survival. Common people of the world will not tolerate imperialism, even under enlightened Anglo-Saxon atomic bomb auspices. The destiny of the English-speaking people is to serve the world, not dominate it.
Following Churchill's speech, conditions deteriorated rapidly. When Soviet troops stayed in northern Iran beyond their March deadline, Truman threatened war. He wrote,
"If the Russians were to control Iran's oil, either directly or indirectly, it would be a serious loss for the economy of the Western world."
Truman later privately claimed to a hardline senator that he gave the Soviets a nuclear warning, telling their ambassador, "If Soviet troops are not out in 48 hours, we're going to drop it on you." They were out, he claimed, in 24. The Soviets did withdraw, but probably for reasons other than atomic blackmail. Less than 2 months later, the U.S. cut off desperately needed reparation payments from West Germany to the Soviet Union. And in July of 46, sending another chilling message about its intentions, the U.S. decided to proceed with an atomic bomb test in the Marshall Islands. In September 46, in front of 20,000 people at New York's Madison Square Garden, Henry Wallace tried to put a stop to the growing madness.
If we persist today in a policy of corruption,
the tougher we get, the tougher the Russians will get. We can get cooperation once Russia understands that our primary objective is neither saving the British Empire nor purchasing oil in the Near East with the lives of American soldiers. Under friendly, peaceful competition, the Russian world and the American world will gradually become more alike. The Russians will be forced to grant more and more of the personal freedoms, and we shall become more and more absorbed with the problems of social economic justice.
The speech became world news, deeply embarrassing to Secretary of State Jimmy Burns, who told Truman either he or Wallace had to go. Support for Wallace poured in throughout the ensuing controversy from such as Eleanor Roosevelt and Albert Einstein, but not from the Truman administration. James Forrestal regarded Wallace as at best a security risk and secretly had his Naval Intelligence Unit monitoring the Secretary of Commerce and shared information with the FBI's J. Edgar Hoover, who harbored deep suspicions about Wallace's loyalties. Wallace, in turn, considered Hoover an American Himmler. Truman later denied he had read and approved the entire speech in advance, which he had. He wrote in his diary,
"Wallace is a pacifist 100%. He wants us to disband our armed forces, give Russia our atomic secrets, and trust a bunch of adventurers in the Kremlin Politburo. I do not understand a dreamer like that."
Truman fired Wallace, and with his departure, the best chance to avert a nuclear arms race was gone. 1947 would be the turning point as the U.S. plunged headlong into the Cold War at home and abroad. Behind the ongoing liberation movements in places such as British Malaya, French Indochina, and Dutch Indonesia, U.S. leadership painted a dire picture of Stalin spreading world revolution, ruling out negotiations and ignoring any grays in its black and white conclusions. In Greece, the British army toppled the popular leftist National Liberation Front and restored the monarchy in right-wing dictatorship, sparking a communist-led uprising. Following the severe winter of 1946-7, the financially strapped British could not control the revolt and asked the United States to take the lead in defeating the Greek insurgents and modernizing the Turkish army. One State Department official later summed it up. Great Britain had within the hour handed the job of world leadership to the United States. A war-weary public had no appetite for costly initiatives, but Truman, addressing both houses of Congress, appealed for $400 million, laying out a new vision for America as the world's policeman.
"The very existence of the Greek state is today threatened by the terrorist activities of several thousand armed men led by communists. At the present moment in world history, nearly every nation must choose between alternative ways of life. I believe that it must be the policy of the United States to support free peoples who are resisting attempted subjugation by armed minorities or by outside pressures.
Truman, in not distinguishing vital threats from peripheral ones, and by linking the fate of people all over the world to the security of the United States, was making a momentous statement. These words could in fact be transposed to Korea, to Vietnam, to Iraq and Afghanistan. After a heated debate, Congress fell into line. Moscow was stunned by this warlike language, accusing the U.S. of imperialist expansion under the guise of charity and trying to extend the Monroe Doctrine to the old world. From outside the government, Henry Wallace led the opposition, decrying the utter nonsense of describing the Turkish or Greek governments as democratic and accusing Truman of betraying Roosevelt's vision for world peace.
President Truman cannot prevent change in the world any more than he can prevent the tide from coming in or the sun from setting. But once America stands for opposition to change, we are lost. America will become the most hated nation in the world.
Anticipating that the Soviets would reply in kind, he warned.
Truman's policy will spread communism in Europe and Asia.
2 months later, the Soviets sponsored a communist coup overthrowing the democratically elected government of Hungary. The New York Times wrote, "The coup in Hungary is Russia's answer to our action in Greece and Turkey." And it clearly contributed to the Soviet decision to impose a new, stricter order across Eastern Europe. The Greek Civil War grew bloody, and U.S. personnel identified as advisors arrived in the war zone in June of 47. The United States amply armed the right-wing monarchy and tolerated their clients' mass political arrests and executions. It was an especially savage conflict, with tactics, some old, some new, that previewed those later used in Vietnam, such as mass deportations to camps, mass imprisonment of wives and children of subversives, executions, the destruction of unions, torture, and napalming villages. Greece was kept in the hands of wealthy businessmen, many of them Nazi collaborators, and the victims were primarily workers and peasants who'd resisted the Nazis. The Soviet Union temporarily assisted the left-wing forces, but in February of 48, Stalin ordered Yugoslavia's Josip Tito, as well as neighboring Albania and Bulgaria, to stop supporting the guerrilla movement.
What do you think? That the United States, the most powerful nation in the world, will permit you to break their line of communication in the Mediterranean Sea? Nonsense. And we have no navy. The uprising in Greece must be stopped as quickly as possible.
The tough Tito, who'd fought his own grueling war against the Nazis and had no fear of Stalin's assassins, refused. And Stalin excommunicated him from the international communist movement, antagonizing hardline allies like Mao in China. The State Department reported, "For the first time in history, we may now have within the international community a communist state independent of Moscow." But despite providing covert support for Tito, the United States never adjusted its rhetoric to reflect that. In the public's mind, the Soviet Union remained at the center of a communist conspiracy to dominate the world. In 1956, out of office a second time and in retirement, the old lion Churchill confirmed in an interview.
"Stalin never broke his word to me. We agreed on the Balkans. I said he could have Romania and Bulgaria, and he said we could have Greece. He signed a slip of paper, and he never broke his word. We saved Greece that way."
Stalin's lack of support for the Greek uprising doomed the rebels, and the war ended with victory in 1949 for the national government. Though U.S. officials cheered the victory, the Greek people weren't so sure. More than 100,000 died, and 800,000 became refugees. Successive Greek governments would use the state apparatus, the police, military, decrees and an intelligence agency to systematically rule the country. Domestically, pressured by the Republican right, Truman found it necessary to appease the public's growing unease with communism. Thus, he mandated loyalty checks on all government employees to root out subversives. Having the wrong views on religion, sexual behavior, foreign policy, or race could make one suspect. Through 1952, loyalty boards reviewed more than 22,000 cases, and more than 4,000 employees were fired or resigned.
The growing menace of communism arouses the House of Representatives Un-American Activities Committee.
In October 1947, the House Un-American Activities Committee held highly publicized public hearings on communist influence in Hollywood. It was an easy target.
Have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
I have told you that I will offer my beliefs, my affiliations, and
Here's the witness.
To the American public, and they will know where I stand, as they do from what I have written.
Stand away from the stand.
I have written for Americanism for many years, and I shall
stand away from the stand.
Fight for the Bill of Rights. I will stand away from the stand.
Hollywood studio executives shamefully denounced those accused and pledged not to hire anyone with suspect affiliations. Although a great number of Hollywood stars publicly criticized the witch hunts, the blacklist gave way to the gray list, and hundreds more were denied work. Among the friendly witnesses who testified were Screen Actors Guild President Ronald Reagan, actors Robert Taylor and Gary Cooper, and studio executive Walt Disney.
I don't believe it's a political party. I believe it's an un-American thing. And the thing that I resent the most is that they are able to get into these unions and take them over.
From 1948 through 54, more than 40 strongly anti-communist motion pictures were made, not including terrifying science fiction parables like H.G. Wells' The War of the Worlds, which implied the threat of communism.
This could be the beginning of the end for the human race. For what men first thought were meteors are in reality the flaming vanguard from the Red Planet.
The FBI, under publicity-conscious J. Edgar Hoover, whose single greatest obsession in life was communism, conducted most of the investigations into its existence in America. Those accused could not know the basis of the accusations. In his paranoia, Hoover distrusted even the White House, the Pentagon, and the Justice Department, and hid what he did, both inside and outside the law, drawing up plans for mass detentions of communists in the event of an anticipated Soviet attack. In July of 47, Truman pushed through the National Security Act, which created a vast new bureaucracy headed by the anti-Soviet hardliner James Forrestal as his country's first Secretary of Defense. The act also created the Central Intelligence Agency, which was given four functions, three of them dealing with the collection, analysis, and dissemination of intelligence. It was the fourth function that would prove the most dangerous. A vaguely worded passage that allowed the CIA to perform other functions and duties related to intelligence affecting the national security, as the president saw fit. The CIA would use that vague wording to conduct hundreds of covert operations around the world, including more than 80 during Truman's second term. Its earliest success was to subvert Italy's 1948 election to ensure victory over the Communist Party. Democracy was apparently a virtue when it served U.S. interests. Sometimes referred to as capitalism's invisible army, the CIA was truly the beginning of a new America built upon a secret state that would grow exponentially over the following decades. Despite his public face, Truman had feared from the start that the CIA could turn into a Gestapo or military dictatorship. In 1963, shortly after John Kennedy had been assassinated, Truman surprisingly but explicitly called for the CIA to end operations and simply gather intelligence. His op-ed appeared in the Washington Post, but strangely generated little discussion in other media outlets and disappeared from public attention. General George Marshall, having led the Allied armies to victory in the Second World War, was named Man of the Year again by Time in January 48 and planned a quiet retirement. But Truman, who'd had more than enough of Burns, forced his resignation and made Marshall his new Secretary of State. Privately believing that Truman's descriptions of a communist threat were exaggerated, Marshall's common sense dictated that the best way to win a war was to prevent it from occurring. What was needed in a ruined and destitute Europe was not a military response, but a humanitarian one. In that spirit, at Harvard University's graduation ceremony in June 1947, America's most prestigious general invited European leaders to submit a plan for economic recovery. Out of this was born the famous Marshall Plan.
Our policy is directed not against any country, the doctrine, but against hunger, poverty, desperation, and chaos.
What the United States did after the Second World War was rare in imperial history. It restored its old rivals, Germany and Japan, and made them economically powerful satellites of the United States.
It is a difficult program, and you know far better than I do the political difficulties involved in this program. But there's no doubt whatever in my mind that if we decide to do this thing, we can do it successfully.
The U.S. eventually spent $13 billion between 1948 and 52, with Britain, France, and Germany being the largest recipients, adding greatly to Soviet fears of German power restored. The Soviets turned down an offer to join the plan as it called for too much American control over the Soviet economy. When Czechoslovakia, a freely elected coalition government, headed, interestingly enough, by a communist party, accepted Marshall's offer of aid, that went too far for the mistrustful Stalin, who demanded the Czechs reject the plan. In February of 48, a Stalinist regime was imposed on Czechoslovakia. The U.S. and many liberals in Europe were shocked. Famous actor James Cagney voiced the following explanation of the Western point of view.
Subversion is, of course, an important technique of communist conquest. Czechoslovakia in 1948 is an established democracy in Eastern Europe. Suddenly, a rash of strikes. Conservative elements resign from the cabinet. But Jan Masaryk, son of the country's greatest hero, will not go along and remains in the Foreign Office. 2 weeks later, his dead body is discovered. Whether he was murdered or killed himself is not known to this day.
Masaryk's manner of death, falling out of his bathroom window, would come to particularly haunt Forrestal and vindicated the darkest view of Soviet intentions. Marshall, however, had told a cabinet meeting the previous November that the Soviets would soon clamp down on Czechoslovakia as a purely defensive move. But Truman seized on the outrage to press the Marshall Plan through Congress, as well as a rearmament program the Pentagon had long been pushing.
The Soviet Union and its agents have destroyed the independence and democratic character of a whole series of nations in Eastern and Central Europe. It is this ruthless course of action and the clear design to extend it to the remaining free nations of Europe that have brought about the critical situation in Europe today.
The U.S. also, at this point, made the fateful decision to press for an independent West German state. Truman described the Marshall Plan and the Truman Doctrine as two halves of the same walnut. Although the plan fueled European recovery, much of the aid was used to purchase exports from U.S. multinational corporations. Little aid was given to rebuild Europe's own indigenous refining capacity, allowing the American oil majors to dominate the European market. The plan was secretly generous to the CIA, which diverted large amounts of Marshall Aid money for covert operations. In the summer of 48, following the Czechoslovakian coup, Truman approved a dramatic escalation of global covert action to include guerrilla operations in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. One project went to creating a guerrilla army codenamed Nightingale in Ukraine, which had originally been set up by the Nazis in 1941, made up of ultra-nationalist Ukrainians. These groups now wreaked havoc in the famine-racked region where Soviet control was loose, carrying out the murder of thousands of Jews, Soviets, and Poles who opposed a separate Ukrainian state. Beginning in 1949, for 5 years, the CIA parachuted Ukrainian infiltrators back into the region. To the Soviet mind, it was as if they had infiltrated guerrillas into the Canadian or Mexican border areas of the United States and signaled the lengths to which the U.S. was willing to go to dislodge Soviet control of their own border areas and sphere of interest. The CIA was equally active in Germany, taking over the Gehlen organization from the U.S. Army. Gehlen, a former Nazi who'd run intelligence in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union for Hitler, recruited a network of Nazis and war criminals drawn in part from the Gestapo and SS. And in the ensuing years, it painted the worst possible picture of Soviet actions. A retired CIA official acknowledged, "He fed us what we wanted to hear. We used his stuff constantly, and we fed it to everyone else, the Pentagon, the White House, the newspapers. They loved it too, but it was hyped up Russian boogeyman junk, and it did a lot of damage to this country." When in June of 1948, the U.S. instituted currency reform in the three western sectors of Berlin, which was 100 miles inside eastern Germany, in order to replace the popular black market American cigarette, the Soviets saw this as a major step in establishing an independent West German state, as well as a betrayal of the U.S. promise to provide reparations from the inherently more prosperous Western zones. The Soviets cut off rail and road access to Berlin. Stalin said the Western powers had forfeited their right of access because they were shattering the post-war framework of a unified Germany. The Western media decried the savage cruelty of the Soviets' Berlin blockade, trying to starve civilians into submission. But contrary to this widely held view, the Soviets, for all their faults, guaranteed West Berliners access to food and coal from the Eastern Zone. U.S. military intelligence confirmed this. What most people do remember, however, is that over the next 15 months, in a heroic defensive maneuver against Soviet aggression, the massive Berlin airlift organized by General Curtis LeMay delivered food and fuel to 2.2 million people in a besieged city. Truman, who was willing to approve the use of atomic weapons, wrote in September, "We are very close to war." France had little enthusiasm for this U.S. initiative, fearing a remilitarized Germany. Nor did Britain, but the U.S. gambled that its atomic monopoly would win out, rejecting Soviet attempts to compromise until it achieved both a basic law outlining a West German state and the creation in April of 1949 of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. This, for the first time in its history, committed the United States to a peacetime military alliance with Western Europe. Its objectives won, the U.S. now agreed to talks on the future of Germany. And it was then that the Soviets lifted the blockade.
Then the Soviet gave up. Their blockade was lifted. The United States and Britain had kept faith with the people of Berlin. The lifeline of supply remained open.
Germany was now officially divided. And in return for its foreign aid, the U.S. would, with NATO, militarize France, England, Italy, Germany, and later station nuclear weapons on German soil. In effect, the U.S. was declaring Western Europe the first line of defense and potential launching pad for World War III. As the 1948 election loomed and the Republicans were heavily favored, Henry Wallace declared himself the Progressive Party's candidate.
The bigger the peace vote, the more definitely the world will know that the United States is not behind the bipartisan reactionary war policy which is dividing the world into two armed camps. The people of the world must see that there is another America than this Truman-led, Wall Street-dominated, military-backed group that is blackening the name of democracy all over the world.
Truman's political people unleashed a vicious red-baiting campaign using liberals to accuse the former vice president of being a tool of Moscow.
I do not want and I will not accept the political support of Henry Wallace and his communists.
Although Wallace repeatedly denied any involvement with communism and warned that charges of it were being used to undermine American freedoms, mobs broke up his rallies, universities denied him the right to speak on campuses, and his supporters were sometimes fired from their jobs.
Glenn, I think the American people are going to surprise us very, very pleasantly next fall.
So do I.
Wallace's running mate, Idaho Senator Glenn Taylor, was arrested and beaten up by police in Birmingham, Alabama, for entering the gathering of a Southern Negro Youth Congress through a door marked colored. Wallace wired Taylor.
This dramatizes the hypocrisy of spending billions for arms in the name of defending freedom abroad, while freedom is trampled on here at home.
The communist charges and the dismissive treatment of Wallace by the major newspapers took its toll. Wallace's campaign was a disaster. He came in fourth behind a South Carolina segregationist. But his progressive agenda on domestic issues, especially civil rights, seems to have influenced Truman. In the end, there was a surprising last-minute rush to Truman by Democratic voters, now fearing a Republican victory and allowing Truman to upset heavily favored Thomas Dewey. Though it was one of the great come-from-behind miracle tales of U.S. politics, Harry Truman, like Churchill, would watch his presidency crumble. In the next 4 years, he would see his support plummet, leaving office with historically low George W. Bush-level approval ratings. In September 1949 came the first of three major events, none of them unforeseen by the laws of cause and effect. Truman shocked the nation.
We have evidence that within recent weeks, an atomic explosion occurred in the USSR.
In 1948, Oppenheimer had said, "Our atomic monopoly is like a cake of ice melting in the sun." As Henry Wallace had warned in 1945, Truman and his group were terribly wrong to assume that U.S. would have an ongoing monopoly on the bomb. Americans felt more vulnerable than ever, and the nuclear arms race that Wallace and the scientists had so feared now escalated as the U.S. hastened development of a hydrogen bomb. As 1949 ended, the world's largest and most populous nation, China, turned communist. When Mao Zedong routed the corrupt nationalist forces of Jiang Zemin, it was unquestionably the most important revolution since Russia's 1917 overthrow of the Tsar. Time magazine warned of the red tide that threatens to engulf the world. General Douglas MacArthur wrote in Life magazine, "The fall of China imperils the United States." Acting outraged as if the corrupt nationalist loss had not been anticipated, the conservative China lobby in the U.S. found guilty not only the Soviet Union, Democrats, State Department China experts, but also Secretary of State George Marshall. These would prove to be false accusations. In subordinating world revolution to their own immediate security concerns, the Soviets had provided minimal assistance to the revolutionaries and little encouragement. Stalin did finally form an alliance with Mao in February of 1950, but urged the radicalized Chinese leader to maintain cordial relations with the U.S. Both sides made exaggerated claims against each other, but China's commitment to revolutionary change and U.S. refusal to recognize the legitimacy of the new government with a seat at the United Nations while recognizing dictator-run countries doomed any efforts at peace. In June of 1950, North Korea invaded South Korea, and the Cold War now turned hot for real. Both Soviet-installed dictator Kim Il-sung in the north and U.S.-backed dictator Syngman Rhee in the south had been threatening to unify the country by force. Distressed by the U.S.'s rebuilding of Japan, with whom the Soviets had fought two bloody wars, Stalin gave Kim the green light to beat the South to the punch. Stalin told Kim Il-sung the war was a way to get back at the arrogant behavior of the United States in Europe, the Balkans, the Middle East, and especially its decision to form NATO. On the other hand, knowing the industrial power of the U.S., Stalin did not want a wider war. Importantly, the Joint Chiefs and the State Department had openly acknowledged Korea to be outside the U.S. defense perimeter in East Asia. But with communist victory in China and revolutionary forces threatening to overthrow Western-backed regimes in Vietnam, Malaya, and the Philippines, Truman felt he had to make a stand somewhere, and Korea was the newly appointed place.
If we let Korea down, the Soviets will keep on going and swallow up one piece of Asia after another. If we were to let Asia go, the Near East would collapse, and no telling what would happen in Europe.
Despite deploying tens of thousands of troops, Truman refused to call the intervention a war, labeling it instead a police action. Although it was nominally a United Nations effort, the U.S. provided half the ground forces and almost all the naval and air power. Most of the other ground forces were South Korean. Truman opted as well to bypass congressional authorization, setting the stage for future interventions. The war and its bloody, indecisive three-year course would cost Truman dearly. As for James Forrestal, though his views had helped shape the poisonous anti-Soviet climate in Washington, he'd been on the losing end of several policy battles with Truman and was relieved of duty with a ceremony in March of 49. He was shattered. When friend and future CIA Director John McCone came to call, Forrestal, becoming increasingly paranoid, pulled down the shades and sat away from the window so as not to give a sniper an easy target. Who he was afraid of, he never specified. Rumors hit the press and went worldwide that Forrestal was discovered in the streets in his pajamas shouting, "The Russians are coming." The Pentagon announced Forrestal had gone for a routine checkup at the Bethesda Naval Hospital in Maryland. He was diagnosed with reactive depression.
Stop! Will you tell these fools I'm not crazy? Make them listen to me before it's too late!
Listen to me. Please listen. If you don't, if you won't, if you fail to understand, then the same incredible terror that's menacing me will strike at you!
Alone in his room on the 16th floor, he suffered constant nightmares of persecution. He thought he would suffer the same fate as Czechoslovakian Foreign Minister Jan Masaryk, to be pushed out of a window. But his condition began to improve, and on the night of May 22, 1949, he stayed up late copying Sophocles' The Chorus from Ajax, where the hero ponders his fate far from home. At the word nightingale, he put his pen down. 16 floors up, he jumped. Philosopher and newspaper columnist Walter Lippmann wrote of Forrestal, "He was like a doctor who studies a disease and then contracts it himself." Behind him, Forrestal left a newborn Pentagon establishment, which, faced with those struggling for a different world, saw only communist conspiracies. There is still today a fundamental misunderstanding that the United States entered the Cold War in response to Soviet aggression worldwide. There is no doubt the Soviet leadership imposed repressive and, when challenged, brutal dictatorships on Poland, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, East Germany, Albania, and Czechoslovakia. But it is equally clear that the Soviets were initially willing to accept governments friendly to them in these countries until the West began to make threatening moves both on their ideology and their security. During this post-war period, it was the United States with its atomic monopoly, not the Soviet Union, which bears the lion's share of responsibility for starting the Cold War. The pacifist A.J. Musty wrote in 1941, "The problem after a war is with the victor. He thinks that he has just proven that war and violence pay. Who will now teach him a lesson?" Beginning with Truman's first day in office, his receptiveness to the views of hardline anti-communists, his denial of Roosevelt's understanding with Stalin, the provocative and unnecessary dropping of the atomic bombs, his spreading a network of military bases around the world, Churchill's speech at Fulton, Truman's call for fighting communism in Greece, the division and remilitarization of Germany, the continued testing of bigger and bigger atomic and hydrogen bombs, which he used to threaten the Soviet Union, Truman's deliberate exaggerations of the communist threat both overseas and at home, and his persecution and silencing of those who challenged these distortions. In all these matters, with few exceptions, the United States, after successfully liberating Western Europe, was now signaling fear and aggression. Why this fear? It has been said that as Americans, we are an immigrant people to a new country, people who in one way or another have escaped persecution and poverty and fear. And though separated by two enormous oceans, are still subject to that incessant fear. Even our sons and grandsons. North Americans have been taught and enamored of the myth of starting over with a new purity in a new land, the myth of American exceptionalism in a new Jerusalem, a city on the hill. Is it necessary then to exaggerate the fear of persecution from abroad, from the corrupt foreigner who would always represent the old and evil ways?
Hordes of grasping, pushing foreigners who are stealing jobs from American workmen and bread from American homes. It is to combat this peril that we, the challengers, have raised our rallying cry, America for Americans.
Are you willing to protect your job?
Well, you bet.
I'm glad to hear that, because we got a pretty bad problem here in this state. It's full of foreigners all trying to chisel jobs out of Americans like you and me.
Well, I certainly am obliged to you for telling me, Mr. Taylor. The first one of them foreigners that comes messing around my job is going to find himself in a heap of trouble.
Oh, it ain't going to be one, Metcalf. You gotta fight all of them. You see, they stick together, these foreigners, and they'll knife you in the back before you even know who they are. An American alone ain't got a chance.
In the early 21st century, there would be almost 300 million guns in American homes. We are the most heavily armed nation in the world. But when any nation goes to an extreme degree to protect itself, it's inevitable that that protection will never seem psychologically to be enough. It is also often true that the image of the enemy will grow proportionate to the size of the defense, resulting in an overreaction and accelerated spending of energies in a futile attempt to liquidate that fear which never seems to erode. Fear and uncertainty are two inescapable elements in all human life since the beginning of time. They are to be accepted as one accepts birth and death. It was Alexander the Great who reportedly addressed the notion that if you can conquer your fear, you can conquer death. And in co-enduring with and containing our fear and uncertainty, we become naturally stronger. The irony of life, personal and public, is that often with the changing of time, the object of fear, the enemy, becomes, to the surprise of former enemies, a friend, often a best friend or ally. Clearly, in hindsight, U.S. leaders had exaggerated the threat from an enemy they felt they needed, wanting to frame the world as an existential clash between two antagonistic social systems. Henry Wallace, who warned that the source of all our mistakes is fear, had said it could be a healthy competition between those systems. But the hardliners of American society felt that this was impossible, and Henry Wallace was dismissed as naive. James Forrestal, one of those hardliners, the first Secretary of Defense, thus ended his life in a violent fashion that would become a strange omen for an American foreign policy that was increasingly terrified of its own shadow. 50 years into this century, halfway from 1900 to 2000, the United States had forged the foundation of a new mindset. It had developed into a full-fledged, if unique kind of empire, economically supreme and massively armed, policing the world while professing liberty and democracy. For a policeman, it's necessary to locate and arrest enemies of its social system. Thus, the story of the next 60 years of American history will resemble a pattern that has already occurred in the shape of increasing covert activities unknown to the people of the empire, more and more regional wars, and a form of control that is imposed over and over again.
If history teaches us anything, it is that we must resist aggression or it will destroy our freedoms.
You are in the crosshairs of the bomb site. An enemy is centering on you. You are a citizen of the free world, a citizen of the United States of America. You are the target.